What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up, PNG celebrates 50 years of independence, and an attempt by Australia to ink a defence treaty with Papua New Guinea falls short. And Vanuatu's climate minister says Australia's emission targets are far too low. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, Papua New Guinea was the focus of attention this week as the Pacific region's largest nation celebrated 50 years of independence. From Prince Edward to Pacific leaders, the red carpet was rolled out for dignitaries and guests, including Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Liam Fox is the ABC's former correspondent in PNG and returned to the capital, Port Moresby, to cover all the action for Pacific Review.
In the pre-dawn darkness, thousands of people dressed in the national colours of black, red and yellow walked towards Independence Hill near Parliament House. At the top, dignitaries including the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Edward, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and a host of Pacific leaders gathered. As the sun broke over the mountains to the east, silence fell as a huge Papua New Guinean flag was marched in. School children sang the national anthem as it was raised to the top of a 50-metre flagpole. Just as it reached the top, two Royal Australian Air Force F-35 fighter jets made an exquisitely timed pass, catching onlookers by surprise, transforming the solemn mood to one of excitement. Fifty artillery shots were fired, one for each year of independence, each round cheered by the crowds around the parliamentary precinct. Prime Minister James Marape told the crowd they had much to be proud of.
Today we gather on sacred grounds, Independence Hills, where 50 years ago, our nation, Papua New Guinea, was born. Out of many, we became one.
He praised what he called the greatest generation of Papua New Guineans, those who led the country to independence 50 years ago.
They carved out the country we enjoy today. And I want to pause back and step back, say thank you to the greatest generation of Papua New Guineans ever lived. The Sumara generation, the St. Julius generation, and the achievement will never ever be repeated by any one of us, and we stand under the shadows.
There were more than a few tears shed in the crowd, and afterwards people expressed an overwhelming sense of pride in their country.
It was a very emotional feeling. I actually had tears rolling down, and there was an old man sitting beside me, and he was also emotional, so I could literally feel how he probably felt 50 years ago.
Oh, it was amazing. You could feel the citizenship in you, especially as young citizens of the country. It was great.
Excited and also emotional. And also by seeing the flighty jets. Flighty jets are flying above, and we thought that Australia is still always with us.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said it was an honour to be present and pay tribute to the Papua New Guinean and Australian leaders back in 1975.
The Australian flag 50 years ago was lowered. It wasn't torn down. To the great credit of those great leaders led by Mr. Samare, but also to the credit of the Whitlam government, Gough Whitlam showed vision, wanted to make sure that, as he said at the time, that Australia couldn't be free unless Papua New Guinea was as well.
The flag raising was only the start of a day of celebration and commemoration. The lowering of the Australian flag on the 15th of September 1975 is being recreated at Sir Hubert Murray Stadium this afternoon, overseen by Prince Edward. His brother, then Prince Charles, now King Charles III, witnessed the original event 50 years ago.
And that's the ABC's Liam Fox reporting on Papua New Guinea's Golden Jubilee Independence celebrations. Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Riggenvanu, says Australia's 2035 emission targets fall short of what's required to keep communities safe. His comments follow the announcement by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese of emission cuts of up to 62 to 70% by 2035. But Mr. Riggenvanu says the bar should have been set higher with cuts of at least 75%. Here's Mr. Riggenvanu talking to the ABC's Agnes Tupou.
Unfortunately, it's far short of what's required to keep communities in the Pacific, but also in Australia, safe. The science is clear, and it says to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is what we all agreed on in Paris, Australia's target should be a cut of at least 75% on 2005 levels, not the 62 to 70%. And this is something that the global think tank Climate Analytics said in its report it released last week, explaining that Australia's 2035 target should be a cut of around 81%. So the target announced yesterday is unfortunately far short of what we need to really see climate change addressed scientifically and according to the highest possible ambition, which is what the Paris Agreement says these targets should reflect.
Do you think it will undermine Australia's relationship with the Pacific?
Our relationship, Pacific's relationship with Australia is strong. It's stronger than what happened yesterday with these, with the release of these figures. But it does, we are continually frustrated with Australia's inability to meet its legal obligations under the Paris Agreement and now under the advisory opinion from the ICJ to, you know, set the highest possible ambition in its targets, make sure that it's contributing its part proportionate to its the size of its economy and the level of its emissions. This is the equity principle of, you know, common but differentiated responsibilities. The more you are contributing, the more you should reduce your emissions and so on. So we're not seeing that in this target. And the Pacific continues to support the call for the Australia Pacific COP held in the region next year. But very clearly, a part of that will need to be much more attention to phasing out the fossil fuel pipeline in Australia. And that's something that's been very clear from a number of our leaders, that that is what we expect from COP31 next year.
That's it. Well, I mean, and looking at last week only, Australia's government approved, you know, that expansion of a massive coal and gas project. How then do you think Australia's track record on approving these projects affects trust in its climate commitments like this target in the region?
Well, it does undermine trust, I must say. I mean, we have been calling for, you know, no new fossil fuel projects to be approved in Australia. That's been a clear call from Pacific leaders. And then what happened last week, you know, there was a slap in the face for the Pacific, basically. We cannot afford to disengage with Australia. It's Australia's our still, you know, our biggest partner in the region. But these kind of things really test our relationship.
And you did just briefly speak about, you know, Australia and the Pacific possibly hosting COP next year. Again, will this help or hinder that bid?
The bid is underway, and the Pacific just last week at the Pacific Island Forum Leaders Summit in Honiara, the leaders re-endorsed, gave their support again for Australia and Pacific as co-hosts. Next week in New York at the Climate Week at the General Assembly, the Pacific will continue to lobby with Australia for this COP to come to the region. And that's because we see that we can benefit a lot from having the COP here, particularly in terms of bringing the finance we need into the region to help us with our transition, to help us with our adaptation, to help us with, you know, the Pacific Resilience Facility, for example, that was just signed off last week in Honiara, bring resources into the Pacific that can help us. But at the same time, we don't want this joint bid greenwashed, essentially, to be a greenwash of actually what's happening in Australia with increasing fossil fuel production. And that's what we're seeing now, and we don't want that to happen.
Vanuatu's climate change minister speaking there, Ralph Viganvanu, and he was talking to the ABC's Agnes Tupou. You're listening to Pacific Review, where we're taking a look at all the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. My name is Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. A former commander of Papua New Guinea's Defence Force is raising concerns about a new security treaty being negotiated with Australia. Once enacted, the Puk Puk Treaty will integrate the military forces of both countries and will compel signatories to come to each other's aid in the event of an armed attack. The treaty was supposed to have been signed this week, but it's been delayed because Papua New Guinea's cabinet were unable to meet due to the country's 50th independence celebrations. Instead, a joint communique was signed between Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his PNG counterpart James Marape. But former military commander Jerry Singerock says the treaty needs to be discussed in PNG's parliament first because it could potentially be in breach of the constitution.
I think the Prime Minister Marape got it wrong. The cabinet does not have the authority to enter into a security treaty because it violates a potential violation against the PNG constitution. And therefore, the first process is for the cabinet to determine whether we enter into a long-term security treaty. And then it has to be tabled in parliament. It has to be debated in parliament because it will require a constitutional change. The constitution is everything to us because it implicates Papua New Guinean soldiers or Papua New Guinean citizens working with the Australian army for the interest of Australia. This is about Australia. This is not about Papua New Guinea, because Papua New Guinea is a sovereign country in 1975. What Australia sees as its threat and enemy is not the same as Papua New Guinea. We're a sovereign country. We can enter into an agreement for joint training, joint exercises, but when it comes to facing a common threat, and it's common knowledge that Australia sees China as the potential threat. And I must say from the outset, is China is not Papua New Guinea's enemy. There's a lot of speculations about the Puk Puk Treaty. It's a disaster if we enter into this treaty without understanding the long-term implication on Papua New Guinea's constitution and sovereignty.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singerock, for that. We understand that the Prime Minister Marape had said that the government had asked for it. The PNG government had actually asked for this. What are you hearing on ground on this, especially?
Those very experienced strategists and lawyers, constitutional lawyers, have already made contact with not only myself but other former commanders about our views, and their views are quite similar to ours. Is that whilst we accept, whilst we acknowledge that Australia is our closest friend, the issue of sovereignty is paramount. Papua New Guinea is an independent country. There has been no public debate. This matter has never been tabled on the floor of parliament for a parliamentary debate because, like I said, there's serious implications not only on the constitution, but on our sovereignty of our nation.
Okay. Do you agree that it's a procedural delay and one that will be signed off once cabinet meets?
The cabinet can sign it off as the prelude to a debate in parliament because, like I said, to absorb the PNGDF or Papua New Guineans into the Australian order of battle is a serious business because it means bringing Papua New Guinea into Australia's interest.
And that was former PNG Defence Force Commander Jerry Singerock, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Belinda Cora. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, bringing you all the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Papua New Guinea's independence is not only a PNG story, it's also an Australian one. Thousands of Australians worked in the country before 1975. Some have even stayed on. The most visible of these were the patrol officers, or KEOPs as they are known. For many, they were the face of the Australian administration, particularly in rural and remote areas. Liam Fox spoke to three former KEOPs who were in PNG at the time of independence. Elderly men now, they still cherish the memories of their time in Papua New Guinea.
Looking at the three elderly gentlemen sitting around a picnic table in a Brisbane park, there's no indication of their colourful pasts. Get them talking, though, and stories of incredible adventures flow freely.
PNG was an unknown country. It was exciting. They were contacting people there for the first time. They appeared to be quite volatile and warfare. The reports were all about unrest in Papua New Guinea. I thought that was very interesting. I was keen for excitement and adventure. That's why I went.
I was at an agricultural boarding school, and an old boy came back and he showed pictures to us boarders of building an airstrip up in Hagen, and I thought, well, that was great.
As a kid, I had an uncle who'd been on Bougainville in the Second World War, and I'd always had this, I think that's where the initial sort of fascination came from. I grew up in the Mallee in Victoria. There wasn't a whole lot going on there. I guess I was looking for a bit of adventure.
Bob Hoad, Peter Salmon and John Dagg were among the hundreds of young Australian men who worked as patrol officers in pre-independence PNG. Bob's first posting was to the Southern Highlands, one of the most remote areas at the time.
I was there for 5 years in all. First thing we did was to contact the people, talk to them, explain what we were trying to do to bring peace to the people, because they were in constant warfare with their neighbours.
Patrol officers were the arms of the Australian administration in what were then the territories of Papua and New Guinea between 1949 and 1975. Some went into areas no outsiders had been before, as this ABC News story from 1964 explains.
Because of the difficult terrain, patrols in this area are short ones. Mark Lynch will be away for about 2 weeks, climbing at times to well over 8,000 feet. It is called a routine patrol. However, in Kuka Kuka country, almost anything could happen.
KEOPs performed several roles: policeman, magistrate, administrator, census taker, surveyor and more. Peter says it was exciting work.
It's always interesting. I think other KEOPs have said the same thing. You posed the question of, well, was it dangerous? Well, it wasn't really. You'd go out to sort out a tribal fight, and if you ever got sort of roughed up, it was by accident. I mean, the locals or the people who were warring, they had nothing against the KEOP, you know.
Though there were times of unease at the actions of the administration and Australian companies, like when John was in Bougainville when the Panguna mine was being developed.
Here we were amidst helicopters, drill rigs being dropped in, what appeared to be endless supplies of brass and steel, and the whole thing unfolding behind us. Then trying to deal with the antipathy of the local people, who saw it as total destruction.
The KEOPs were seen as instrumental in nation building after World War II. As independence drew near, they also became teachers, educating people about self-government and democratic elections. Independence itself in 1975 came with mixed emotions for the men.
It was the end of my career.
I thought this is the way things are going. I knew I wasn't a Papua New Guinea citizen, or I knew I was a temporary feature in the overall scheme of things.
It was then that the real understanding that things were drawing to a sort of natural conclusion following independence.
Such was PNG's impact that all three came back to work in different roles at various times. And after all this time, they still cherish those years and are proud of their contribution to what is now an independent Papua New Guinea. Here's Peter.
Papua New Guinea, that was the best experience we ever had in our lives. I mean, no regrets whatsoever. It was just a fantastic flight.
Former KIAP Peter Salmon ending that report from Liam Fox. The Pacific nation of Fiji has become the only seventh country in the world to open up an embassy in the Israeli city of Jerusalem. Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka and senior officials were on hand for the opening, and they were lauded by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The fact that you have come here and you have put your embassy in Jerusalem and you recognize a truth that everybody should recognize, that this has been our capital for 3,000 years since the days of King David. This is more than a political moment. It's a sharing of great values and great purposes. These values are challenged in our region. We have just been engaged for close to 2 years in a seven-front war against those who don't accept anything that I've just said.
Fiji's decision to open an embassy in Jerusalem has been condemned by human rights groups as it comes in the midst of widespread reports of human rights violations by Israeli forces in Gaza. Despite the criticism, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka reiterates his government's position in relation to Israel. Countless aircraft were shot down over Papua New Guinea during the Second World War, many of which are now valued cultural artifacts for locals and landowners. However, they're also highly sought after by overseas collectors, as landowners in Oro Province learned in 2006 when a famed World War II bomber was salvaged and removed from their land without compensation. Now, after 20 years, a campaign is underway to have it returned to what should have been its final resting place. The ABC's Kyle Evans with this report.
Provisional landowner Ian Jujiro chuckles when he tells the story today. But his grandfather wasn't laughing when a B-17 bomber crash-landed a short distance from his village during the Second World War.
It was, at that time it was in a war and they were, scared. And they were hiding and that plane just, landed in their land.
The plane crashed not too far from the Kokoda track in 1942 in Papua New Guinea's Oro province. For years, it captivated locals, as well as Australian soldiers who nicknamed it the Swamp Ghost, after spotting the plane whilst on a training exercise in 1972.
When we were, growing up, they used to, tell stories about that plane. And we usually go, see that plane. Sometimes we really wanted to, just go around and see the, plane relic. It was untouched. It was there.
Private collectors, however, saw dollar signs. Efforts to salvage Swamp Ghost began in the 80s. Then in 2006, a permit was issued to an Australian, Robert Greinert. He had a reputation for this sort of work. In fact, a parliamentary inquiry estimated he's taken 24 aircraft from PNG at an estimated value of $20 million. Swamp Ghost became one of them.
They came in aggressive. They don't want, landowners or, surrounding villages to, come and buy and, look what they were doing. They just, took it off.
By law, war wrecks are the property of the landowner on which it rests, as well as the PNG government. Each are entitled to compensation if relics are removed by overseas salvers. Yet somehow a deal was struck to ship the Swamp Ghost to the US. And landowners, like Mr. Jujiro, say they never received a cent.
They promised that funding would be divided among state, provincial government and landowners. And nothing happened. That's why I really wanted the Swamp Ghost to be back in Oro province of Papua New Guinea.
Now a fresh push is underway to have the Swamp Ghost return to PNG 20 years after it was taken.
I'm working on how we can bring that plane back because that property is the property of Papua New Guinea.
That's Oro Province Governor Gary Juffa.
However, it was taken across there by an Australian character who basically came in and identified all these World War II aircraft and then he found ways to ship them across abroad.
Governor Juffa remembers the Swamp Ghost all too well. He was Commissioner of Customs when the plane was salvaged.
An NEC decision was put together by politicians who said, no, it's okay because we'll get a replica plane. That replica plane hasn't arrived.
Last month, Governor Juffa penned a letter to PNG's US ambassador in hopes of getting the process started. In the meantime, he hopes to look at ways to strengthen laws to ensure landowners don't get hoodwinked by overseas treasure hunters many of whom are contractors who help governments like the US and New Zealand find wrecks and repatriate remains. Justin Talon from Pacific Wrecks is one of them. He says the industry is a bit like the Wild West.
There are people all over the world willing to bend and break rules to acquire these aircraft at any price. They're worth millions of dollars.
That was Justin Talon from Pacific Wrecks, ending that report by Kyle Evans. And Robert Greenhart has been approached for comment to this story. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.